From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The CIA says it kept drug smuggling Contras on the payroll, but refuses to declassify the study that proves it. We'll speak with journalists Bob Perry and Gary Webb. Also, Seneca Falls Revisited. Historians reenact an imaginary dialogue between Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Frederick Douglass on race and women's rights. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Saturn Corporation workers voted overwhelmingly yesterday to authorize union leaders to call their first ever strike against the automaker General Motors, a step toward joining their GM colleagues on the picket line. GM already is reeling from strikes at two parts plants in Michigan, and a strike could taint the image of Saturn, a GM division that prides itself for harmonious relations with its workers. A strike technically could be called by the end of the week, though negotiations are scheduled to resume tomorrow. Meanwhile, the UAW plans on showing its solidarity in Michigan today. About 300 local union leaders will be in Flint for a briefing on the strikes at two General Motors plants. They'll also hold afternoon rallies in front of both plants. Meanwhile, the automaker is starting an advertising blitz to reassure car shoppers that dealers still have GM vehicles to sell. A spokeswoman says there's a perception that GM is out of cars. This news from Charleston, South Carolina. Macedonia Baptist Church in South Carolina is suing the Ku Klux Klan to make it pay for a 1995 church burning. The lawsuit starts today. Four former Klansmen are in federal prison after admitting to the burning and other crimes. A fifth man mentioned in the suit is the South Carolina Klan's Grand Dragon. The lawsuit claims the fire was racially motivated and meant to intimidate the congregation. Church officials say they're suing to make others think twice before committing similar crimes. An attorney for the Klan says the suit is really about shutting the organization down. This news from Jakarta. The Indonesian government is planning to give former dictator Suharto almost $2 million to build a house. This according to legislators from the Golkar Party. This to a man whose personal wealth is estimated to be as high as $40 billion, the bulk of it believed to be stolen from the country and skimmed off international aid packages like those from the World Bank and the IMF. And human rights workers who are investigating scores of organized gang rapes during 3 days of protests in Indonesia in May say they and the victims have been receiving threats from unidentified men. Some victims have been cowed into silence by threats or by rumors of another round of attacks and rapes. Other victims have committed suicide. Investigators said they had also heard reports of additional rapes and sexual assaults in the weeks after the riots. And it looks like the UN envoy on East Timor went to the occupied country this weekend, but instead of going to the capital, Dili, he only met with Timorese at an Indonesian Air Force base in the city of Baucau. Students had planned to stage large demonstrations to mark the UN envoy, Jamshid Marker's, visit, but many did not even know he had come and gone from the island. This news from Washington is legislation that would protect patient privacy languishes in Congress. The Clinton administration is quietly laying plans to assign every American a unique health identifier, a computer code that could be used to create a national database that would track every citizen's medical history from cradle to grave. The electronic code was mandated by a 1996 law and would be the first comprehensive national identification system since the Social Security number was introduced in 1935. European Parliament members and human rights groups said today they'd written to the United Nations in Colombia urging the release of jailed politicians from Colombia's left-wing Union Patriot Petrodica. The letter addressed to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson, and Colombia's president, and the country's top judicial authorities, alleged two leading UP mayors were being detained despite being cleared by the Colombian courts in 96 and 97 of all charges against them. And this news from Burma. Burma's military junta said it had stopped opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi from going to meet an official of her National League for Democracy party today. It was the second time this month the 1993 Nobel Peace Prize winner has been kept from leaving Rangoon. On July 7th, she was prevented from traveling to a northern township to meet party officials. Russian President Boris Yeltsin, rebuking his parliament, decreed economic reforms to bring Russia closer to meeting conditions for a bailout by the International Monetary Fund. In Washington, officials with the fund said they're still reviewing the measures to see how close they came to fulfilling Russia's obligations. And finally, it looks like the UN Secretary General is headed to Mexico. You're listening to Pacifica Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. And this is today's top story that we'll be looking at in the first segment of today's show. Last week, the New York Times ran a report saying the CIA's own investigation of its activities revealed that agency officials knew that the Nicaraguan Contras they were working with were running drugs. The new report is the long-delayed second volume of the CIA's internal investigation into possible connections between the Contras and Central American drug traffickers. The investigation was originally prompted by a 1996 series in the San Jose Mercury News, which asserted that a dark alliance between the CIA, the Contras, and drug traffickers helped finance the Contra war with profits from drug smuggling. The first volume of the CIA report was released in January. It confirmed that the CIA had blocked federal criminal investigations of Contra drug activities in California. Volume 2, a broader look at the problem, is considered far more damaging to the CIA. It is said to reveal a large drug network and direct tie-ins to Reagan administration officials. We're now joined by journalist Bob Parry, who spoke with sources within the agency who saw the classified report. Bob Parry is the editor of Consortium and a former reporter for Associated Press and Newsweek who broke the Iran-Contra story. We're also joined on the telephone by Gary Webb. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, formerly of the San Jose Mercury News, and author of that Dark Alliance series and the new book, The Dark Alliance, The CIA, The Contras, and the Crack Cocaine Explosion. As a result of his investigation, he was forced out of the paper. Well, Gary, why don't we begin with you in California? Do you feel that reports of this classified CIA study vindicate what you found?
Well, I think primarily it vindicates what Bob Parry and a number of other reporters have been saying since the 1980s, that the CIA knew some of the Contras were involved in drug trafficking and didn't do anything about it. And, you know, after 13 years of denying it, now the CIA has finally said yes. But I think it's interesting that we still don't, we don't even know the extent of the, of this information, because the only thing that came out in the Washington Post or the New York Times was a report by somebody who's talked to people who have seen it. The actual report is still classified, and I saw an AP story move later that said they doubt, the CIA doubts it will ever release the report because it names, it identifies the names of the drug traffickers the agency was involved with, which I think is very considerate of the CIA, but I'm not sure the American public really shares their desire to see, you know, the names of drug traffickers kept secret.
We are joined, as I said, by Bob Parry as well. Bob, your response to the study and your understanding of what exactly it says. You know, I want to say that last week in our news headlines on Friday, I started off by saying that the New York Times had gotten a hold of the documents, the CIA report, because that's what I thought based on a long report that they had in the paper. But then afterwards was quickly corrected by Juan Gonzalez, my co-host, who said, no, if you look carefully at this, no, they don't have a copy of it. It's just that they're getting the CIA spin.
Right. I think that's what the New York Times was doing last week, was essentially giving you what the CIA now is trying to say about their own report. The actual contents are extremely bad for the CIA. It shows a much deeper involvement with Contra, the Contra movement and drug traffickers than any of us ever alleged. I'm told that the number of Contra entities that are involved with the cocaine trade go up into the several dozen. The agency knew about it. They helped cover it up. The first volume of the report, which we do have, does describe how the CIA, in a couple of different cases that they acknowledged, actually intervened with the Justice Department to stop criminal investigations that were underway in the early to mid-1980s in the Contra, into the Contras in the drug trade. So now what we have is the second volume, which is still being kept secret and may never be released in any complete form, but which we're told by sources who have seen it indicate that the CIA's involvement was much worse and the Contra involvement was much deeper with the drug trade than any of us ever thought.
So explain what it is that you understand that they're saying in terms of the numbers of Contras who are involved with drugs.
Well, it's in the several dozen, and I'm not sure you can say just the Contras as individuals. These are entities. Some of them are companies that were working with the Contras. As far back as 85, when Brian Barger and I did the first piece for the Associated Press on the Contra drug problem, we knew at that time that there were a number of Contra entities working with drug traffickers to raise money. Then later when John Kerry, Senator John Kerry, did his investigation in the mid to latter part of the 1980s, we saw even more evidence where there were half a dozen companies that were being used by the Contras that were also involved with the drug trade. It was pretty much put to rest at that point because the Washington Post and New York Times and the main papers did not want to pursue it. Gary Webb revives it in 1996 with his series, and this new investigation finally forced the CIA to bring together all the documents that they could, that they had left, about what they knew about the Contra drug trade. The first volume was bad enough. The second volume now, which is about 600 pages long, goes through a whole variety of these cases, including, I'm told, direct evidence from one of the Contras who was speaking to the CIA about how he received direct orders out of the Reagan White House. So this is a very serious problem. But again, the question is, how much public pressure will there be to force the CIA to put this out in a meaningful form? Right now, the new inspector general, the incoming inspector general, Britt Snyder, has a choice. He can either do a kind of summary of it, which is what they're leaning toward, or he can put out the report with redactions, that is, blacked out portions to cover up names and so forth. The agency told me a week or so ago that the inclination is to go with the summary, which could allow it to be more watered down. But enough people have seen it from outside the agency now that it might be very hard for the CIA to entirely cover this up at this point.
And we know what summaries are about because with the first report that was declassified, the summary made it look like that the CIA had been exonerated, but the actual report was very damning. And so if they were able to just put out a summary, even if people have seen it, it would overall, I think, very much, obviously favor the CIA, and that's the feeling people would ultimately come away with. Now, Gary Webb, I remember when John Deutsch, the former director of Central Intelligence, went to South Central, Los Angeles, and held that town meeting and assured people that there would be a complete study and that the public would be told about what the CIA found about itself.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, the one thing that's interesting about this, and then the words that I did not see anywhere in the New York Times story were the words "after years of denials." This is something that the agency has denied, that the U.S. government has denied knowing about ever since Bob and Brian started writing their stories. Now they're finally turning around and saying, "Well, I guess we did know something about it." And to me, it's not often that the government changes its official position. And after, denigrating and ridiculing reporters for years who were trying to tell the story, now they come out and say, "Well, yeah, I guess it's so, but we're not going to tell you the details of it. We're not going to tell you how deeply this goes or how far up in the government it goes." One thing that I noticed buried way down at the bottom of the New York Times story, which I thought was very telling, was the paragraph that talked about how most of the allegations were against Contra individuals, but that there was an allegation of drug trafficking against one Contra entity, specifically this group called the Legion of September 15th. Now, if you know anything about the history of the Contras, what that means is the CIA was getting information that the Contras were trafficking drugs from the very moment of the birth of the Contras, because the Legion of September 15th was this group of ex-National Guardsmen who were hiding out in Guatemala in late 1980, and they merged into they merged to become the FDN in 1981 when the CIA took over the operation. So the CIA was getting information even back then that Contra officials with the Legion of September 15th were involved in drug trafficking. That means they knew from the get-go that they were dealing with potential drug traffickers. And I thought that was something that was a very damaging admission, because that's right at the birth of the Contra movement.
You know, yesterday on one of the Sunday talk shows, I believe it was Tim Russert's Meet the Press, Howard Baker was on, the former chief of staff of President Reagan. And though he wasn't asked specifically about this, he did feel the need to talk about it and said that when he came into office, he insisted that President Reagan, you know, come clean on anything he knew about Iran-Contra, and that the president did do that.
Did Baker say that? I did not watch the shows. But I think one of the interesting points that we've also seen that came out in early May was this report, or the release of some letters that were written between William Casey and Attorney General William French Smith back in 1982, in which William Casey engineered the exemption for the CIA having to report about drug activities by their agents or clients, in effect. This was an extraordinary document, because it showed that Casey went to such great lengths to allow the CIA to be saved from having to report their information about these criminal activities, while he agreed to report criminal activities on a whole variety of other types, even perjury, visa violations, almost you name it. But the one that he wanted removed from that list and got removed was narcotics trafficking. So we had clear evidence at that point, as early as February of 1982, that William Casey was laying the groundwork to protect the agency from having to report about these kinds of crimes by whether it be the Contras or by the Afghan Mujahideen or others that the agency had been involved with. So we have evidence not just of cover-ups that followed, we have evidence of premeditation for those cover-ups. And I think this is at a point where this is a major national scandal. And for the Washington Post and the New York Times to continue to treat it in this rather dismissive, light way. The Washington Post hasn't even reported anything about this second report.
Oh, they haven't?
Not that I've seen.
Okay.
And the New York Times did finally put it on the lower left-hand corner of the front page, but in a rather watered-down, diluted way. And I'm told inside the New York Times the feeling was, well, this still doesn't prove that we were wrong.
Well, you know, those letters that you were mentioning, Bob, and you put it in conjunction with the knowledge that the CIA had that the Legion of September 15th was dealing drugs, that takes it before the letters were actually signed and this exemption was engineered. So now you've got a situation where the CIA is being told that their Contra, and the Legion of September 15th became the leadership of the Contras. I mean, they were the hardcore of the Contras. So they had this information, and then they went and got the exemption. So now we're even back further, and now it looks even worse, frankly.
No, it does. It does appear that we have a case where the U.S. government knowingly and willfully engaged in the protection and the collaboration with drug traffickers. There were a number of cases we now know where evidence came forward, both from the news media and from other federal investigations, that implicated the Contras. And instead of pursuing that, and instead of trying to bring these people to justice and protecting the American people from the drug plague that we were supposedly waging war on, the Reagan administration consistently, over a number of years, protected the Contras, subverted these various investigations, and then tried to destroy journalists and others who came forward with the information. It's a rather remarkable tale of a government completely out of whack, but it also suggests that there's a media out of whack when this doesn't even register as a serious news story. And when people like you raised it as late as 1996, the feelings of the Washington Post, New York Times, and others was that you needed to be attacked for raising it again.
Well, what's pathetic about all this is, after the work you did and after the work the Kerry people did, it was still a non-story. And it's only when the CIA finally confesses to this that the New York Times finally says, well, maybe there's a story here somewhere. Now, if you want to talk about who's leading who, you look at this. This is a perfect situation. If as long as the government continues to deny it, the New York Times and the major media will pretend it's not a story. It's only after they have a confession, essentially, that they will treat this seriously and put it actually on the front page, but still dismiss, you know, the work of other people that helped bring this stuff forward.
I mean, Gary Webb, I have to interrupt here so stations can identify themselves, but we're going to come back to both you and Bob Perry. Again, we're talking about the CIA's report that says, yes, indeed, it was paying drug smuggling Contras, but it's refusing to declassify that study. Our guest, Gary Webb, who's reporting at the San Jose Mercury News prompted the investigation of the CIA. And we're also joined by Bob Perry. Bob Perry, who is now editor of Consortium, and will tell you how you can get his newsletter, which is online, in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, here with my guests, journalists Bob Perry, who is now the editor of Consortium. He was formerly with Newsweek and Associated Press, where he broke the story on the Iran-Contra scandal, but ultimately wasn't able to do the reporting he wanted to follow up on that story in these news organizations. Gary Webb, who was able to do that reporting for a little while, but ultimately also was driven out of the journalism business. He was a reporter with the San Jose Mercury News, did the Dark Alliance series looking at the CIA, the Contras, and crack cocaine, particularly as it flowed into South Central Los Angeles. Now he works with the California legislature after the San Jose Mercury News put him on the suburban beat. We are talking about this CIA report that apparently has been completed by the Inspector General Hitz, where the CIA is implicated very clearly in paying drug smuggling Contras, although apparently, at least according to the New York Times that reported the CIA spin on the report, though they don't have the actual documents, the actual study that the CIA has done, apparently they're saying that one of the differences between the CIA's report, Gary Webb, and your news reporting is that the CIA never says that their point, their purpose was to inundate, say, the black communities of the United States or to bring drugs into this country, but that the purpose was to support the Nicaraguan Contras. And this was an unfortunate side result of that, that these Contras were dealing in drugs.
Yeah,
what do you make of that?
Back. You know, it's what happens at home once you do a covert operation overseas. And frankly, I never said that the purpose was to do anything other than raise money for the Contras to buy weapons anyway, so at least we're in agreement on that. You know, you got to think about this. This is the best the CIA can spin this story, which tells me that that report is a whole hell of a lot worse than what we know. Like Bob was saying, the figure I saw in the Times story said there were upwards of 50 Contras or Contra organizations that had allegations of drug trafficking against them. And the agency continued to work with about two dozen of them after receiving this information. I suspect that a lot of the names of the people who were doing it have already been made public. I think John Kerry said something along those lines, that he read the report. He saw that a number of the people that were named in this thing were people that his investigation had exposed back in the 80s, and that the rest of the information wasn't worth keeping secret. So you know, lost in all this is the fact that there's another report out there that is 400 pages long, and it has been declassified in December and is still awaiting release, and that's the Justice Department internal investigation. Because if you've read my book, you'll see that the knowledge of these contra drug traffickers was not limited to the CIA. It was also known by the FBI. It was also known by the DEA. And the Justice Department report was to take a look at what all these other federal agencies knew about these traffickers and what they did, if anything. And Janet Reno is still holding that report up. And I saw something in Time magazine, I think it was last week, that said that report may never be released or there's no current plans to release it. So,
even though the man who did that report, Michael Bromwich, apparently wanted that report released.
Yeah, he, you know, I corresponded with him afterwards. And what he said was that they were all ready to release it. It had been declassified. It had been signed off on. It was all sitting there ready to go out the door. And at the last minute, Janet Reno's office jumps up and says, well, there's some law enforcement concerns about this, which, you know, when you consider that all these crimes were committed 10, 12 years ago, I can't imagine there's any pending law enforcement investigations going on into them. Although, you know, there may be. I mean, we may have investigations out there that are even longer than Ken Starr's.
You know, you can't help but think, when you look at the media's obsession with the whole Monica Lewinsky case and the amount of reporting that they have done on that. Now, there have been many, many mistakes, reporting of leaks that didn't pan out.
Same dresses.
Yeah, right. They continue to harp on that. Could you imagine if the Sunday talk shows spent as much time looking at this? One of the things they do is they say, Gary, because you made mistakes in your reports, the whole thing is absolutely untrue. That's what they basically say. If they were to do that, they would have had to stop talking about this a year ago, the Monica Lewinsky case, when you look at all the mistakes they've made. Yet they continue. What about this idea of a national media project that would go after this story with a vengeance, if you will, but would go after with this story that you began, actually, and Bob Perry, you before Gary Webb, with the Iran-Contra story, but really devoted all of their resources.
Well, that issue actually came up. There's an organization called IRE, Investigative Reporters and Editors, and I was at their convention last year in Arizona, and someone made the suggestion that they do an IRE project on the Contra drug issue. And a lot of the reporters objected. I mean, I was sort of surprised to hear it, but it was primarily reporters from the Miami Herald who were complaining that, you know, we don't want to do this because this story's already been discredited and we don't want to go into it. You know, there's not only resistance by the government to do this, there's resistance by the media, and I think part of that reason is because they've done such a horrible job of covering this story since the 1980s. When you get right down to it, I think you can actually make a case that they have assisted the CIA in covering this thing up, because any time a journalist would try to report this, the reaction of the mainstream was, well, he's a kook or he's a conspiracy theorist or he can't get his facts straight. And now we know, you know, finally, the CIA has admitted that what everybody was saying was true, and it was the media that was out there spreading disinformation about this topic to the American public. So they've got a lot to lose.
Right now, John Kerry, the Democrat of Massachusetts, the senator who you were just talking about, he does have the security clearance to read this report, and he has, and it's quoted in the New York Times responding and saying it should be made public. But what about the senators who have been able to read the report, who do have the security clearance? Bob Perry, what do you think they should do?
Well, I think, first of all, there's been a real resistance in Congress to read the report. Because the fear is that if you read a report like this and it leaks out, you could be held accountable for leaking classified material. So many members of Congress have expressed a real concern about doing that. But a limited number have seen the report at this point. Everything we're hearing is that this is indeed a far worse picture than anyone had ever imagined it would be. But as Gary said, almost a bigger problem right now than the government is the big news media. And I think Gary's right that when Brian Barger and I did the first piece back in December of 85 on Contra drug trafficking for the AP, and then followed up on that, there was just enormous resistance from the Reagan administration, obviously, because they did not want their allies, the Contras, to be shown to be drug traffickers. President Reagan had called them the moral equal of the founding fathers. So there was a lot at stake. But instead of the press being skeptical of Reagan, who had an obvious reason to cover this up, the press really joined in helping to protect the Contras from the real crimes that they were committing, and did a real disservice to the American people. And I think that's why we're seeing this enormous resistance to dealing with this in a serious way. And I think the people who have tried to do it have systematically had their careers damaged for doing so. So many reporters feel this is not one they want to get into. The big papers have all said it's not really that big a deal. So let's leave it there.
Barry McCaffrey, the drug czar, should be demanding all of this be released. I mean, one of the implications of both the CIA report being classified and the Justice Department report being classified, I think Janet Reno said this isn't an implication, that it could jeopardize ongoing investigations right now. Well, if this information could jeopardize ongoing investigations, it makes you think this is continuing today.
Right. I think there are indications, and my information on this is very limited, but that there may actually be U.S. government officials who were directly implicated and who might be under investigation at this point. I think that's the sensitivity. Hmm. And it could be an ongoing conspiracy in another sense, not necessarily tying to the Contras, but in a larger drug conspiracy tying to the operations in Colombia and elsewhere.
Well, we're going to wrap up this discussion, but any last words on how this could become a national media project? I mean, even if the IRE, the Investigative Reporters Organization, there was resistance to it, and Gary Webb, you're no longer with the San Jose Mercury News, you're working as an investigator with the California legislature. People do have your book to read, which is also called Dark Alliance, the book Dark Alliance, which looks at the CIA, the Contras, and the crack cocaine explosion. But how do you think this could be prompted?
Well, it's going to have to be a grassroots effort. I mean, the media is not interested in exposing it. The public's, the Congress is not interested in getting into it because it makes both sides look bad. It's going to have to come from public pressure on their congresspersons and on their elected officials to release this report.
And perhaps calling every news organization.
Well, I mean, at this point, a lot of it's just historical information, and we're being denied access to our own history here. I think somebody essentially needs to file suit against the CIA and say, okay, justify before a judge why you think this is protected by national security. And I can't imagine that the fact that they were working with drug traffickers and they want to spare them and the agency from embarrassment is enough to convince a judge that this thing ought to be held secret.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Gary Webb, formerly with the San Jose Mercury News, now the author of a brand new book, Dark Alliance, the CIA, the Contras, and the Crack Cocaine Explosion. His series in the San Jose Mercury News led to this CIA investigation of itself that they're refusing to release right now. Bob Parry, editor of Consortium, former reporter with Associated Press and Newsweek. If people want to get a hold of Consortium on the web, which, by the way, in the latest issue, deals with this report that the CIA has put out, where can they go?
Well, the URL on the Internet is www.consortiumnews.com. We also have been following this in our bimonthly investigative magazine called IF Magazine, and that can be obtained by calling 1-800-738-1812. So you can either get the print version of these stories, which is in the magazine, or go on the Internet.
Well, I want to thank you very much. 1-800-738-1812. Bob Parry, Gary Webb. Thanks. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And following on this issue of secrecy, we just wanted to touch on another story. It was the front page of the Washington Post yesterday. And it said, when President Clinton announced 3 years ago that he was ordering automatic declassification of millions of the government's oldest secrets, he didn't mention the blanket exemption for the FBI. Well, Washington lawyer James Lazar said he discovered the deal last month in the course of litigation against the FBI for records on three women involved in left-wing causes dating back to the 1930s. James Lazar joins us on the telephone right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
So tell us about how you found out. I mean, there are a number of organizations, like, for example, the Center for National Security Studies and other public interest groups that thought and had actually praised this order from President Clinton that millions of documents would be released from the CIA, from the National Security Archives, from the FBI, looking at this country's history. And now, through this little lawsuit that you got involved with, we find out that the FBI is exempt. What is this memo that you got?
Well, how it came about is that the FBI invoked national security to protect some of the information in some of these 40 and 50-year-old records that are at issue in the case. And they claimed that the information was exempt from Clinton's executive order. And I said, wait a minute here. The executive order does apply. It does provide that an agency can obtain an exemption from the automatic declassification provisions, but to do so, that decision can only be made after a determination by the head of the agency, after a review of the records, and after approval by the president, by the White House. And all they had given me was a declaration by an FBI agent. And so, to try and shut me up, They produced a copy of this October 1995 memorandum by Attorney General Janet Reno to the White House asking for an exemption for every piece of paper the FBI has.
And
I was just absolutely blown away by it. Something that you couldn't conceive of unless you had the actual proof right in front of your eyes.
It's interesting. This very big article in the Washington Post goes on to have FBI people saying, don't worry, though, we are going to follow the spirit of this. But of course, if they were going to follow the spirit of it, why would they have sought this exemption?
Yeah, well, if they follow the spirit of it in their usual manner, the records will be declassified about the time the planet turns to toast.
Well, Attorney Lazar, who are the women that you're trying to find out information on from the 1930s?
Well, the most prominent of the three was Dorothy Wolfe Douglas, who for a time was married to Senator Paul Douglas, who had been the famous liberal senator from the state of Illinois. And she was very active in a number of left-wing causes, was suspected by the FBI of being a communist, and so there's a quite substantial file on her. The other two women were also active for a time, although I think one of them later recanted her left-wing beliefs, her initial left-wing beliefs. The files on them are substantially less, not as voluminous.
And those were the Lumpkin sisters?
Yes, Catherine Dupree Lumpkin and Grace Lumpkin.
Well, I can tell you, I'm feeling a lot safer not knowing the information about them from the 1930s. I think our national security has been enhanced.
Well, you and the FBI share something in common there.
Well, the figures in this article are astounding on how much information the FBI has. They say something like they have 6.5 million cubic feet of records. That would translate into something like 7.8 billion pages.
Yes. And it's not clear. That appears not to. It's not clear to me whether that includes the field office files or not.
Well, we're going to continue to follow the story, but I just thought it was very important following up our discussion of classified documents at the CIA and also at the Justice Department that people should understand that something that the president was really praised for, this order declassifying secrets of our top intelligence agencies, in fact, is not a blanket order, and the FBI is exempt. And I want to thank you.
And I would add just one quick point there that the FBI is, in a sense, the most important of all the governmental agencies because during that period of time and until recently, it has been the primary social historian of the country through its activities covering every form of dissent. It has become the history keeper of the nation, in a sense.
Well, James Lazar, I want to thank you for joining us. James Lazar, an attorney based in Washington, D.C., whose lawsuit against the FBI to find out about three women of the left-wing persuasion in the 1930s led to the discovery of this memo between the executive office and the FBI that the FBI was exempt from the presidential order declassifying government secrets. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, an imaginary dialogue between Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Frederick Douglass. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, today, 150 years ago in 1848, is the day when the first Women's Rights Convention was in its second day and when they voted on their Declaration of Sentiments. This was 300 people, men and women, at the first Women's Rights Convention. Among those there, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Frederick Douglass. Today, we bring you a dialogue between Frederick Douglass and Elizabeth Cady Stanton by two academics, Sally Rush Wagner, who is an historian who has dealt extensively with Elizabeth Cady Stanton's work, and Charles Pace, who plays Frederick Douglass, a visiting anthropologist at Center College in Danville, Kentucky, and a member of the Great Plains Chautauqua. They came together in Seneca Falls this past week to perform a dialogue, and I got a chance to talk to them at the Women's Rights National Historical Park. Here they perform, and we begin with Sally Rush Wagner as Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
Before we held our first women's rights convention, so of course we would expect his assistance. And we got more than we'd even hoped for, because when that resolution was being discussed, that women must have the responsibility, the duty, to exercise their sacred right to the franchise. You see, this was not anything that we were asking anyone to give to us. We were citizens of a republic. And what is a republic? It is a government based upon the consent of the governed. We had never given our consent to the government, or to the laws, or men who ruled over us. We, as citizens, had the duty to exercise our sacred right to the ballot. It was simply a matter of figuring out how to do it. But when that resolution was introduced, there was a general sense that it was just too far in advance of its time. And it wasn't until a voice so eloquent, a voice so full of knowledge, having known the absence of freedom himself, being denied the elective franchise himself, it was the voice of Frederick Douglass that carried the day. And when he spoke for the suffrage resolution, it passed. And then, all the trouble began. It always surprised me. I thought if it was reasonable to me, it would be reasonable to everyone else, and that was not the case. There was such an outcry about this Women's Rights Convention. Many of the original signers just took their names off. My father disinherited me. He did later, I will say, re-inherit me, but such was the strength of opposition, Had we known its strength, I don't know if we would have had the courage to begin. But begin we did. Soon there were yearly conventions. National conventions started in 1850. And this small, little convention in this tiny village in New York State grew into a national movement. We held our conventions yearly, abolitionists, temperance, women's rights, all at the same time because we were all of one ilk. We each fought the other's battle. And it would have gone on that way had it not been for the aftermath of the Civil War. You see, there was a Republican elected. My husband was one of the founders of the Republican Party, the Grand Party of Reform, the anti-slavery party. And when Abraham Lincoln was elected president, we had not favored him initially, but it was a Republican who was in office now. This meant an end to slavery. And this man elected on an anti-slavery party ticket proceeded to fight the war, not to end slavery, no, but to preserve the Union. It was a betrayal absolute. Susan B. Anthony and I founded the Women's National Loyal League, and we gathered 300,000 signatures, the largest number of signatures that had ever been gathered on United States soil, saying, we will support this war effort only if it is being fought to end slavery. We were part of that driving force behind Abraham Lincoln that gave him the backbone to finally issue his incomplete Emancipation Proclamation. But we ended slavery. And then the war was ended. And then it was time for the door of freedom to swing wide open, and it was time for the woman and the Negro to walk through arm in arm. But no. First came the 14th Amendment. The Constitution before had said nothing about women. You see, it did not recognize the oppression of women. It did not foster it. It did not speak to it. The Constitution was neutral. The 14th Amendment wrote the word male into the Constitution three times in connection with citizenship. Male citizen, male citizen, male citizen, throwing into question whether women were even citizens, making us political slaves in the moment of releasing the slave of color. I spoke against that 14th Amendment. And the 15th, which enfranchised only black men, leaving women outside. Robert Purvis rose in one of the equal rights meetings and he said, I have a son and a daughter. I would rather that my son wait 50 years to get the ballot than that my daughter wait one more minute, because as a woman and as a Negro, she is doubly in need of the protection of the ballot. I said some things of which I later took some shame. But I was angry. I was angry at the betrayal of these men who we had fought for their freedom. And now they turned their back on us. Not only closing the door to our freedom, but writing us out of the Constitution for the first time. Oh, yes, it was the Negro man's hour. And he walked into freedom, but he left all women, white and black, behind the closed door. Of that, Mr. Douglas, you stand accused.
You're listening to Sally Resch Wagner as Elizabeth Cady Stanton. In fact, this performance is happening at Declaration Park in Women's Rights Historical National Park at Seneca Falls, New York. And now Charles Pace, playing Frederick Douglass, responds to Elizabeth Cady Stanton's accusation.
With us, it was a matter It is a question of life and death, at least in 15 states in the Union. When women, because they are women, are hunted down through the steep streets of New York and New Orleans, when they are dragged from their houses and hung up on lampposts, when their children are turned and torn from their arms and their brains dashed out upon the pavement, when they are objects of insult and outrage at every turn, when they are in danger of having their homes burned down over their heads, when their children are not allowed to enter schools, then they will have an urgency to obtain the battle equal to our own. It was never a question, really, of turning my back. I agree that women have equal right to the ballot as black men. But it's a question of urgency, and it's a question of necessity. They are represented. They are represented by their husbands, by their brothers. They are represented by their sons. But black people, black men, have no such representation. So it was always a question of timing. And as soon as the 15th Amendment was ratified as giving the black man the right to vote, immediately I joined with my friend Elizabeth and said that the 16th Amendment should be the amendment to give women the right to vote.
And Mr. Douglas, would you allow your master to represent you? Would he speak to your interests? Would he vote your needs? No, he would not. And neither would the husband. It is not sufficient, it is never possible for one to represent another. No, we must have. It is at the foundation of our government that we must each have representation. Our voices must each be heard.
Well, on that point, there is no question. You're absolutely right. Women have as much right, but not more of a right. And as I said, with black people, it is not just a matter for political representation, as important as that is. It is literally a matter of survival. It is literally a matter of life and death.
Oh, Mr. Douglas, there were nights living here in this village of Seneca Falls when I would hear a knock on the door and I would answer knowing who was on the other side. It would be a child, usually a small boy, and he would be terror-stricken. I would follow him through the streets. Sometimes we would hear the screams before we reached the house. And when we entered, there would be the one he loved most in the world, her face battered and bleeding, pulled by her hair, perhaps slammed against a wall. And who was the terrible fiend committing this deed? The one she loved most in the world, the one she had given her love to, and the one church and state alike had required her to obey. And when she went to the state said, no, you must live with your master every bit as much as the state said to the slave, you must live with your master. And if she ran, if she fled, anyone harboring her was subject to civil action. She was a runaway wife being harbored. And when she went to her minister and asked what she should do, she was told that marriage was a covenant with God. It was not an agreement between people, and it could not be broken. She must go home and pray for his soul. It is, Mr. Douglas, with women a matter of life and death as well. You know, the Supreme Court in the state of South Carolina decided that it could not take a position on a husband beating his wife because to do so would upset the domestic tranquility of the home. And you know the legal tradition that it is all right for a husband to beat his wife as long as he does it with nothing bigger than his thumb, the rule of thumb. Marriage should be a matter of love. And when I have called for women to be free to leave loveless and dangerous marriages, I was called a heretic. It is a matter of life and death for women to have their personhood respected and recognized by law, the law which now renders her invisible once she is married. No, she can have no right to her children. She has no right to her property. She has no right to her wages. She cannot sue or be sued. She cannot live where she wishes. She cannot even keep her own name. And I ask you, Mr. Douglas, is this not a form of slavery?
Well, I would not use the term slavery. I'm very conscious that that means something totally different than what happens in the status of women. Slavery meaning that you are property, that you have no right that the white man is bound to respect, no right as a human being in the American form of slavery. And of course, I am against that. I mean, in the very first issue of the North Star, I proclaim up front that right is of no sex. And so you know as well as anyone where I stand on this issue. It was you, after all, who radicalized me. You know, those years when I was not a woman's rights man, and I would say things like the woman's sphere is the home, and that her delicate condition would not allow her to speak in public. And it was you, Elizabeth, as reasonable then as the young woman as you are today, who turned me around on that issue. And I find myself in a position, however, to make this argument and ultimately to conclude that reasonable people can disagree. And on this issue of whether or not the 15th Amendment will be a universal amendment or one to give black men the right to vote, I have to say, I believe this is the black man's hour. And I have to say that we have reached an impasse and that reasonable people can disagree as we do on this issue.
And Frederick, it is difficult to stay angry at you. When I do remember those talks as we walked in Boston, and you taught me about the rights of the slave as well, and I will never be able to thank you sufficiently for standing at that Seneca Falls convention, supporting the suffrage resolution and saving the day. I think you're wrong, but you're my friend.
Well, thinking about that Seneca Falls resolution, I have done very little in this world in which to glory except that one act. And I certainly glory in that. When I ran away from slavery, it was for myself. When I advocated emancipation, it was for my people. But when I stood up for the rights of woman, self was out of the question, and I found a little nobility in the act.
More than a little. More than a little.
Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Frederick Douglass, played by Charles Pace and Sally Rush Wagner. They can be reached and do their performances around the country at 540-723-0214. For a copy of our show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Joe Gill's our engineer, Hisu Koo, and Jeremy Scahill, our producers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks.